You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It is 10 years since police raided homes throughout the country and set up a roadblock in Ruatoki to arrest people on charges under the Terrorism Suppression Act. These charges never held up. Te Rangi Kaiwhiria Kemara of Ngāti Maniapoto and Rere Ahu and Tame Iti of Ngāi Tūhoe were both imprisoned on firearm charges. They were released before finishing their sentences, and yesterday it was announced they are seeking pardon from the allegations of terrorism. Kemara stated that, from the suppression of Parihaka Peace Settlement to Ruakianana, striking miners at Denison Coal Mine, to the Watersider strikes of the 1950s, Bastion Point to the brutal suppression of Springbok protesters, the latest being the paramilitary raids of Te Uruwera. This is about confronting the history of this country. It is a history of police forces in various manifestations constantly abusing their powers. Until this is confronted, these things will continue to happen over and over again. The terrorism charges were never laid. The Solicitor General promised the government and courts it would deliver enough evidence to lay terrorism charges once the raids were carried out. The government signed off the raids and the courts issued the omnibus dragnet warrants, which came up mostly empty. This country is being dragged kicking and screaming to confront the racism in its recent history. Even as we speak, Tūhoe Whānau are working on a pardon for Ruakianana, and I believe the Crown has finally agreed after many decades to formally apologise for the lasting damage to the mana of Ruakianana and, even more importantly, the pain people suffered because of the invasion. I believe the choice of wording by the Solicitor General at the time that the reasons for the terrorism charges not being laid being due to the complexity of the Terrorism Suppression Act was nothing more than arse covering. They had a lot riding on the dragnet raids and they did not find what they promised the government and the courts they would find. I believe this left the Solicitor General in the extremely awkward position to make something of the mess he helped create. So rather than just say that charges of terrorism could not be laid, I believe, therefore, he chose to augment it with the complexity myth and a need for the act to be amended, something that even to this day has not occurred. This has left the terrorism cloud over our heads, and the stigma associated with that will carry on for generations. We have also seen a partial admission by the Crown of pain and suffering it caused by the raids, but that apology specifically excluded those of us arrested and our whānau who are suffering from the invasion and associated stigma. We are therefore left with the pardon. It's not the process of our choice, but the only one available under the Pākehā justice system to remove the cloud of terrorism for our children and their children and for restoration processes to begin. This may take years, decades or more to achieve. So be it. Those are the words of Te Rangi Kaiwhiria Kemara. Valerie Morse is part of Auckland Peace Action and I speak with her about what happened in 2007 and whether police brutality is still an issue. What happened to you on the morning of the 15th of October in 2007?
On that morning, I was in my flat of sorts in Trades Hall in Wellington, and the police came, a lot of police, came at about 5 o'clock in the morning, banging on the door, demanding to be let in, and they rolled in and told me that I was under arrest to be charged under the Terrorism Suppression Act.
Did you know what that was at the time?
I did know what it was, yeah. I had done a lot of work around the Act, actually, in the past. So I had a pretty good understanding of what the Act was. And I thought that's one of the reasons why I was really, really, really quite in shock when they told me that.
What did you have to deal with from that point?
Well, after that moment, the police placed me under arrest. They took me down to the Wellington police station, they processed me, and then later in the day, after we'd been sitting in the cells most of the day, they took us to court, and they told the judge, this is the police and police prosecutor, told the judge a whole lot of really crazy stuff about how we were terrorists and how we were planning to assassinate George Bush and maybe Helen Clark. And they said they wouldn't let us out, and so they sent us to prison. So they sent us to jail for we didn't know how long, and they refused us bail. And so that night, on the 15th of October, we went off to Arohata Women's Prison. And I say we because I was arrested along with a few of my friends, and one of them was another woman. So in a way, I was really lucky to have a friend with me, so I wasn't entirely alone. But it was a pretty scary experience. So then over the course of the next few weeks, we remained in prison. We were unable to get bail. And at the time, the police put a whole lot of evidence before the Solicitor General, who is the top lawyer in the country, because they can't bring charges under the Terrorism Suppression Act independent of a decision from him. So he has to say, yes, the police can bring these charges. So the police put all kinds of crazy stuff before the Solicitor General, all these extracts of intercepted conversations from people's telephones, and said, these people are a bunch of terrorists. And meanwhile, we sat in jail waiting to get out. And after about a month, the Solicitor General actually came back and said that there was insufficient evidence to continue to hold us, and there was insufficient evidence to bring those charges. So at that point, we were released. But all of us were still facing charges under the Firearms Act. So the Firearms Act was a much lesser charge, and so we were released pending, you know, a court trial.
None of that evidence actually held up, and eventually you guys did get off those charges, most of you?
Well, so it was a very, very long journey, I guess, and for anybody who's ever been through any of the criminal justice system, you'll know that the process of going through the system is largely what constitutes the punishment. What comes at the end is called the punishment, the sentence that you get. But the punishment actually starts pretty much from the time you get arrested, because even though people say that you're innocent until proven guilty, really, there's a strong tendency to treat people who have been arrested as if they were already guilty. So for us, going through the process of the court process, which for me lasted another 4 years, was punishment. I was, you know, required to go to court all the time. We had long preliminary hearings called depositions hearings. We had heavy-duty bail conditions, which meant, you know, that we couldn't go certain places, we couldn't associate with certain people. But I suppose the biggest penalty, in a way, is the financial penalty. You know, the literally hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of legal costs that all of us had to foot. And you know, many of the other people I was arrested with literally don't have two pennies to rub together. But even for those of us who were working or had jobs or had some, you know, house or whatever, the financial costs were just enormous. So carrying that for years and years and years, and some people still carrying off, you know, trying to pay off lawyers and things for charges that they ultimately were never, you know, never even stood trial on. So that's kind of what happened. And what happened for, so there were sort of 17 or 18 of us, and the number changed off and on because various people had been arrested and then some people got dropped out of the case. It all sounds extraordinary at this point, but the 13 of us eventually were, the charges against us were dropped in the Supreme Court after the court ruled that the evidence couldn't be used against us. It was illegally obtained evidence, and so they had to throw out the whole case against us. Meanwhile, five of the people actually went ahead to trial, and that was Rangi Kaifiria, Tama'iti, Tuhoi Lambert, Emily Bailey, and Orr Signer. And Tuhoi Lambert actually passed away. Before the matter ever went to trial, he was a Vietnam veteran and suffering from quite a lot of exposure to Agent Orange and, just a lot of sickness. And so he never even made it to trial, and I think Operation 8 probably ended his life quite a lot early. But those guys did go to trial. They were eventually convicted on the lesser firearms charges. They had a charge of being an organized criminal group, but the jury didn't believe that. So they, Tommy and Rangi did about a year and a half, I guess, of their 2.5-year sentence, and Orz and M did 10 months of home detention. So all in all, you know, a giant disaster for the police, but they did successfully do what in many cases I think a lot of people would say they wanted to do, which was really crack down on dissent. Political protest, particularly Māori aspirations for Tino Rangatiratanga.
Mm. So it does seem that that's where the issue lay. Given that this took a really, really long time and there wasn't an apology until 2014 from the police, do you think that people have forgotten that this has happened? Has this become part of, you know, New Zealand's historical amnesia?
I think people have largely. I mean, the interesting thing I think for me is that I'm now organizing politically with people who are a generation younger than I am, and they actually were only, you know, in some cases 9 or 10 years old when that happened. You know, so they don't actually, they have a the vaguest recollection of it, but they don't have any, they don't really have any knowledge of it. They don't have any personal knowledge of it, I guess. So I think it's interesting that there has been a focus on this 10-year anniversary, and in a way that's, you know, that's good, but there has perhaps been a lot of, yeah, a lot forgotten along the way, and how really troubling that whole episode was. But I suppose that it fits in really well with a wider picture of historical amnesia in this country about issues of colonization.
Is that the reason that we should be reminding people that this happened?
I think to some extent, yes. I mean, it's interesting. When the Terrorism Suppression Act was passed, Māori organizations went to Parliament and they said, if you pass this law, it will be used against Māori. And of course, members of Parliament said, "Oh no, 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 no! You know, it's not intended for that." And of course, the very first outing, the only time that piece of legislation has ever been used in this country, it was used against Māori almost exclusively. You know, I'm Pākehā, but I think 13 of the 17 people arrested were Māori, almost all Tūhoe, but not exclusively Tūhoe. So there were people from Ngāpuhi and Te Atiawa who were also arrested. So. Yeah, I think that we really, really have to look when Māori are talking about what it is that they're saying and look back at that history and go, oh yeah, well actually there's quite a lot of evidence to back up what you're saying.
Last week you were in Wellington for the Weapons Expo. Given that there was a lot of police violence there last week, do you think that this sort of police brutality is, it was quite an extreme event in 2007, do you think that that is still possible?
I think that the police actually regularly use that kind of violence. I mean, I think that the kind of raids that happened in the Uruwera, they perhaps don't happen on the scale that they happened in 2007 on that particular day, but they do happen in a lot of Māori communities on a regular basis. And there's certainly been the use by the New Zealand police of military gear and the military itself for carrying out what are police operations. So, for example, there was the quote-unquote Kawerau siege 2 years ago in which a guy who was wanted for doing nothing more than growing marijuana, they sent in a tank to arrest him. And the same thing for a guy in Hastings a couple of years ago, a guy called Jan Molinar. Police sent in a tank to get this guy out of his house. Like, these are people definitely with mental health problems, potentially with violence problems, but the extent to which the public is willing to accept this kind of hyper-militarized police. Like, I'm not suggesting that it is of the same caliber as what's going on in the U.S., but it's certainly on a continuum, and I think that the police regularly use excessive violence in communities. It's just that most of those communities are poor and brown, so we don't see them a lot.
Do you want to add anything else?
I guess what I would say is that in terms of the Weapons Expo and in terms of the protest, the blockade, which was really, really awesome, I think, you know, that along with terrorizing Māori communities, the New Zealand police have a long history, actually, of targeting protests. Like, they have stood against those people on the front lines, for example, in the Watersider strike, against workers who are seeking better wages, better conditions. They've stood against women seeking the vote, for God's sakes, in this country. You know, that the police brutality that we witnessed last week was unusual only insofar as it was, we don't often have that kind of large-scale mass direct action. If we had a lot more of that going on, we'd probably see a lot more that kind of police violence on a regular basis.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō. The Wire.